When Jews talk about exile, the discourse is typically, as we've seen, a geographic conversation, placing Galut in relationship to the historical fantasy of a return to the land of Israel. See the rhetoric surrounding the destruction of the first temple, the exile to Babylon, destruction of the second temple, the massive dislocation that was suffered under the Roman Empire imply that a return to the land will usher in that long sought after feeling of being at home. This is especially accentuated in certain figures in religious Zionism, perhaps foremost among them Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. Rav Tzvi Yehuda lived in a tiny, very small apartment in Geula in Yerushalayim, and on the walls of his apartment were pictures, first of all, of his father, Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. There was also an old photograph of his grandfather, who was a renowned Torah scholar known as the Aderet. But he also had a photograph of another bearded Jew, and that was Theodore Herzl. And alongside the photographs, he had a drawing of a sunrise over a mountain with the caption, "So too unfolds the redemption of Israel, in the beginning, little by little." Because Rav Tzvi Yehuda was utterly bewildered by the fact that Jews continue to live in the diaspora. Well, what is Galut, he asked? An aberration in our normal, healthy state. We need to be here. The entire nation of Israel in the land of Israel. And all of the land of Israel needs to be in our hands. And thank God, Hashem's light is shining on us now and increasing in strength little by little in gradual stages. Now, it is instructive, actually, to compare this normative sentiment with some of the writings of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, one of the great Talmudists and Jewish thinkers of the 20th century. As you all know, the descendant of a rabbinic dynasty, Rabbi Soloveitchik, in turn was instrumental in ordaining about 2,000 rabbis, and as having been an important figure in trying to think through the potential synthesis between Judaism and modernity. I say potential synthesis because the relationship between Judaism and the world was often a tense encounter in his writings. And he certainly never advocated any easy kind of fusion of the West with traditional Jewish life. More often than not, actually, his work suggests a radical dichotomy of choice, either or of God intoxication or secular degeneracy. And let's let him speak for himself if you take a look at source number one. Judaism declares that man stands at the crossroads and wonders about the path he shall take. Before him there is an awesome alternative, the image of God or the beast of prey, the noblest of creatures or a degenerate creature, from Halachic Man. In this talk, we'll examine, based on the analysis of the Israeli philosopher Avi Sagi, some of Rabbi Soloveitchik's understanding of alienation and exile, especially as they relate to the existential fact of being alive for a finite amount of time in a world shot through with loneliness. Rabbi Soloveitchik is very skeptical of the ability of human beings to negotiate the world in a meaningful way without God. In Reflections of the Rav, he argues the inability of modern secularism to motivate ethical behavior in private or public life is evidence of this truth. Caught between the lure of earthly drives and the promise of divine love, human beings have a momentous choice to make about which way they want their lives to go. And what is striking in Rabbi Soloveitchik's formulation is his insistence that no one can truly save another person. The impetus for redemption has to be self-initiated, as he says in source number two. Judaism has always held that it lies within man's power to renew himself, to redirect the course of his life. In this task, man must rely upon himself. No one can help him. He is his own creator and innovator. He is his own redeemer. The picture here is of a kind of Emersonian self-reliance, both empowering and yet frightening in its stark assumption of human alienation and hence the responsibility of each individual for their ultimate fate. Rabbi Soloveitchik assumes that alienation is the ground of human existence. And here we begin to see his sharp divergence from the theme of exile as a geographical aberration as opposed to a human reality. Look at source number 3. From an existential metaphysical perspective, exile is a universal experience. Our exile is but a reflection of the general metaphysical consciousness of exile oppressing every human being, and not only the Jew. Man was cursed by God and sent away from Eden as a homeless creature. To talk in this fashion about homelessness and exile is to leave behind the timeline of recorded events and to place into grave doubt the ability of any historical action, even one as significant as the rebirth of the State of Israel, to fully redeem this condition. Unlike Martin Buber, who describes historical periods where human beings feel more or less at home, Rabbi Soloveitchik understands alienation as a permanent feature of existence. Thus, the traditional version of exile is but a shadow of this far deeper isolation. He traces the origins of alienation to the very formation of human identity. In Lonely Man of Faith, based on the double creation story in Genesis, he famously distinguishes between two mythical human archetypes, between Adam 1 and Adam 2, as he calls them. The first Adam, or majestic man, employs his creative faculties in order to master his environment, as mandated by God. The second Adam seeks covenantal relationship, finds himself by succumbing to God's will. But in this self-realization are ironically the seeds of complete estrangement, because to be is to be different than others. And to be different than others is finally to be alone, which is the upshot of the central passage of Lonely Man of Faith, as you see here in number 4. And defeated must Adam the second feel the very instant he scores his greatest success, the discovery of his humanity, his I identity, the I awareness which he attains as the result of his untiring search for a redeemed, secure existence, brings its own antithesis to the fore, the awareness of his exclusiveness, an ontological incompatibility with any other being. Adam the second suddenly finds out that he is alone. The philosophical language here carries a deep emotional wallop, ontological incompatibility, which is the inherent inability for any human being to really fit with another. Know or be known by another is a pervasive theme in Rabbi Soloveitchik's worldview. Elsewhere in Lonely Man of Faith, he drives home the point again in Source 5. For what causes man to be lonely and feel insecure, if not the awareness of his uniqueness and exclusiveness? Once you are aware that you are a unique self, the immediate resonance is that others are not like you and never can be. As you might imagine, such a set of facts provokes a deep sense of uneasiness within some, but not all of us. A feeling that life is stripped of any raison d'etre, that our days are a facade hiding the unthinkable. Something that Rabbi Soloveitchik speaks of unflinchingly, as in this passage in Source 6. We are aware that our lives commenced and will be terminated without our consent. We lack faith in the justifiability of our existence, and we are bereft of an ontic fulcrum. This is a metaphysical experience, not merely psychological or rational, a pervasive meaninglessness, purposelessness, and an absurdity of life convey themselves to the introspective, sensitive person. I noted a moment ago that this uneasiness is the province of only some of us. This seems to be Rabbi Soloveitchik's view. The more sensitive you are, the more you allow yourself a full, unrepressed, emotionally complex view of the depths of life, the more you will tune in to the potential sadness just below the surface of the day. As he states, a pervasive meaninglessness, purposelessness, and absurdity of life convey themselves to the introspective, sensitive person. One can see this differentiation throughout Rabbi Soloveitchik's work between the sensitive as opposed to this sort of out-of-touch person. For instance, in his well-known comments on whether prayer is a biblically mandated commandment, there's a well-known machloket rishonim that's based on the Gemara between the Rambam and the Ramban about whether prayer is a mitzvah d'oraita, whether it's a Torah-mandated mitzvah. And they disagree about this issue. The Rambam states that it's a positive commandment to pray every day. The Ramban argues that the Torah obligation to pray applies only in times of acute distress. So according to the Ramban, you'd really only pray from the Torah. We're not talking about the rabbinic sort of codification of prayer. According to the Bible, the Ramban says you'd only pray when you felt suffering, when you felt acute distress. In attempting to reconcile the positions of these two Rishonim, Rabbi Soloveitchik asserts yet again this vast gulf that he sees between the sensitive and the oblivious soul, as he says in Source 7. Both regarded prayer as meaningful only if it is derived from a sense of tzara, distress. They differ in their understanding of the word. Maimonides regarded daily life itself as being existentially in straits, inducing in the sensitive person, there's that word again, feelings of despair, a brooding sense of life's meaninglessness, absurdity, lack of fulfillment. It is persistent tzara, which exists b'chol yom, daily. Real prayer is derived from loneliness, helplessness, and a sense of dependence. Thus, while Nachmanides dealt only with surface crisis, tzarot tzibur, public distress, Maimonides regarded all life as a depth crisis, a tzarat yachid. So the reason we pray every day, says the Rambam, because every day, if you're alive to it, presents acute existential distress. And it's hard to miss, really, in Rabbi Soloveitchik's anguished reflections on absurdity, the influence of the major existential thinkers here, obviously Kierkegaard, Camus, Sartre, especially Kierkegaard's renowned summation of life in his work Repetition in Source Number 8. I stick my finger in existence. It smells of nothing. Where am I? Who am I? How came I here? What is this thing called the world? What does this world mean? Who is it that has lured me into the world? Why was I not consulted? And if I am to be compelled to take part in it, where is the director? I should like to make a remark to him. Is there no director? Whither shall I turn with my complaint? Interestingly, much the same sentiment is expressed every single morning in Jewish prayer. In the passage, which is also the cornerstone of the Yom Kippur Ne'ilah service. What are we? You'll remember these words because we've prayed them so many times. What are we? What is our life? What is our kindness? Our righteousness? What is our salvation? What is our strength? What is our might? The preeminence of man over beast is non-existent, for all is vain. Right? Very, very parallel passages. The bleakness of this prayer is only alleviated by the presumed promise of salvation by God, contingent on human surrender. And it's, of course, that element that would fundamentally separate Rabbi Soloveitchik from the perspective of Sartre, Camus, and others. As Adam Gopnik writes of the latter, the big question Camus asked was never the Anglo-American liberal one, how can we make the world a little bit better tomorrow? Camus' question was the grander French one. Why not kill yourself tonight? Camus struggles to answer what he considers to be the only question of philosophy, right? Very famous, right? Which is, does the realization of meaninglessness and absurdity of life necessarily require suicide? That's Camus' question. Now, I do not believe that this is Rabbi Soloveitchik's question, but not because he necessarily dismisses such a question out of hand. In fact, I think it's a question he understands very, very well, all too well. But the difference is that halachic man is not l'étranger, right? He's not the man with no purpose at all who engineers these random acts of ethical nihilism. Nonetheless, the world is a difficult place in Rabbi Soloveitchik's rendering of matters. And of one thing he is certain, because he says it over and over again, no amount of mastery of the world, no amount of material mastery, no amount of conquest, no amount of pseudo-power can obscure the basic fact of our fragility, our temporariness, and hence our anxiety, our dread. He puts it this way in Source 10. Modern man is wise and powerful, sharp, adept at all areas of science and technological research. His calculations near perfection, still he fears, feels insecure. So there is no escape from the emptiness of life itself if life itself is all there is. But for Rabbi Soloveitchik, the path leads more to Kierkegaard than to Camus in the following sense. Although he accepts alienation as the fundamental human condition, he does not adopt the interpretation of the sort of atheistic side of existentialism. As Professor Sagi points out, Rabbi Soloveitchik assumes that the desire for transcendence, the reaching out for God, is a basic human need. We can quarrel about whether that's true or false, but that's what he felt. And alienation for Rabbi Soloveitchik is a result of when that passion, that need, goes unfulfilled, when you cannot connect. So even if absurdity is a fact, what we do with absurdity, the meaning we derive from it, depends on how we view life. The absurd, for Rabbi Soloveitchik, is the gateway to God. It's the potential gateway anyway. You note in source number 11 how he converts the tragic to the transcendent. At one point or another, in the long voyage of life, man must reach the absurd stage wherein he will find himself abandoned and impoverished. Man must acknowledge this tragic fact. A person, unaware of the contradiction deeply embedded in his personality, lives in an illusory world, unredeemed. What he calls this tragic fact becomes the fuel for religious passion, the ground for dvekut, the attachment to the above, as he says in source number 12. The transcendental adventure, the flight of the alone to the alone, is precipitated by despair. Amazing idea, actually. It's despair that is the catalyst for the reaching out. Man, in his chancing upon the contradictory and absurd in life, apprehends the vision of a hidden God. This phrase, the flight of the alone to the alone, he borrows from Plotinus, the Neoplatonic philosopher, and it suggests that the individual and God are actually mirror images of one another in isolation. God in God's isolation, us in ours. But it is we who reach out and find God in his aloneness, and in doing so, redeem our own unbearable ethereality. However, I want to make a distinction here. Merely recognizing that you feel alienated or you think life is absurd is insufficient from a Jewish point of view, because recognition without redemptive action, more often than not, is just the grounds for narcissism. It's just self-destructive. So you walk around all day saying life is absurd and tragic and meaninglessness, and you have not fulfilled Rabbi Soloveitchik's dictum. Because here, other elements begin to coalesce in his thought, the axioms of religious Judaism upon which he relies to begin to forge a meaningful life. And those redemptive possibilities lie in prayer, of course, in halacha, and perhaps most crucially and maybe most surprisingly, in attachment to other people. Let's start with prayer. He links prayer with redemption, but only prayer of a certain type, usually not the kind of prayer we see around us on a daily basis in Jewish communities. He writes in Source 13, the experience of redemption and salvation is a precise representation of the idea of prayer. To pray is to alleviate terror. To pray means returning home. There's the exile and homecoming theme, totally divorced from geography. I wonder how many of us feel when we get up, whenever we pray, that our prayer is a means of alleviating terror. Here, Rabbi Soloveitchik, of course, is connecting prayer with the end of exile. Because God, not any country, God becomes the home for each individual, the ultimate home. So it goes beyond geographic dislocation, although obviously geographic dislocation is a part of it, right? One cannot divorce the actual geographical facts from the theme of exile, and I'm not trying to do so, but it's more complicated. In existential galut, which is really what he thinks about, in existential galut, only the longing for and the reaching out to something beyond the human can really justify the word home. The source of real alienation is the distance from God. No matter where you live, be it a remote part of the diaspora or the old city of Yerushalayim, prayer offers this possibility of homecoming, what he calls an interrelationship with God, which can dispel the existential restlessness and unhappiness of man. But it's not only God or with God that human beings must make a connection. He borrows Buber's categories quite freely, and he assumes that the core of alienation is what he calls the existential alienation between the I and the thou, however close they may be. However close they may be. I was very struck by that. Here, his picture of the inherent loneliness of life is reconfirmed. Despite all the loved ones in our lives, we are at the root of it, he says, lonely. Because, for Rabbi Soloveitchik, our deepest feelings and our deepest experiences are actually not communicable. As he says in Source 14, to be means to be the only one, singular and different and consequently lonely. There is no one who exists like the I. And because the modus existentiae, the mode of existence of the I, cannot be repeated, imitated, or experienced by others. Of crucial significance is that this state of affairs does not lead Rabbi Soloveitchik to resignation, does not lead him to nihilism or to futility. The imperative for human beings to connect, despite the difficulty of piercing this innermost eye of the other person, remains in place, something he believes in. The paradigm, actually, for this movement, our movement out of isolation, is God's movement out of isolation at Mount Sinai. Revelation is actually the paradigm for Buber, for sure, if you read I and Thou and Eclipse of God, but also, interestingly, for Rabbi Soloveitchik as well. God's movement towards us becomes the model for us to reach out to one another, as he says in Source 15. If God abandons his transcendental numinous solitude, he wills man to do likewise and step out of his isolation and aloneness. So whatever the limits of communication, it's one of our primary duties to one another to communicate, which raises an obvious difficulty, contradiction, paradox. If Rabbi Soloveitchik sees personal experience as non-communicable by definition, then what would be the purpose of this duty to communicate? Should we not simply remain silent when confronted with this gulf separating us from one another? I don't have an answer to that question. I have a thought to that question. I do not believe that he adopts a black and white attitude to this primary issue of human relationships. Instead, I think that he acknowledges the ultimate mystery within each person, and because of that ultimate mystery, their consequent solitudes. But he asserts that meaningful communication with one another can help to alleviate this loneliness and to create a partial but important redemption of our lives. So it stands to reason that trivial communication, gossip, idle chatter, meaningless conversation, inauthentic emotional exchanges, and the like, actually do not help with this human quandary. In fact, they only deepen the sense of mutual isolation. They act as a screen behind which we hide and sink deeper into our alienation. So if solitude means that I'm a unique individual, unlike anyone else, it doesn't automatically follow that communication is null and void. Rabbi Soloveitchik was actually very interested in friendship, the notion of friendship. I can't speak to his personal friendships, but in writing. And actually, friendship that is redeeming, he looks to Adam and Chava, to Adam and Eve. Each alone and hidden, yet in his eyes mutually caring, as he says in the last source, while mutually revealing themselves to God in prayer and unqualified commitment, Adam and Eve also reveal themselves to each other in sympathy and love on the one hand and in common action on the other. And whether this is an historically accurate picture or a romanticized one is actually irrelevant. It's Rabbi Soloveitchik's use of Adam and Eve as a paradigm for the redemption that we can bring into each other's lives that is significant. For all of his, you know, I've spent weeks reading him and it's rather gloomy, to be honest. For all of this gloomy existential discourse, he's also open to reshaping our lives through the power of our choices and through our openness to one another in authentic ways. So as Professor Sagi notes, if you define the human task as the transition from exile and alienation to redemption, if that's really what we're going for in our lives, in our work, in our relationships, in our religious communities, if that's what we want, whoever accomplishes this task is the Messiah, something that Rabbi Soloveitchik believes possible for every human being, right? He, as we saw earlier in Source 2, he said that you rely upon yourself, you're your own redeemer, and in fact, he says in the continuation of that passage, I don't have it here, he says, man is his own redeemer, he is his own Messiah, who has come to redeem himself from the darkness of his exile to the light of his personal redemption. Okay, I wanted to leave time for questions, so I'm just going to close. What can we ultimately take away from this brief perusal of Rabbi Soloveitchik's existential reflections? And how do they relate to exile, the theme at the heart of the day? So, speaking personally first, I consider myself a bit of a homeless Jew. I ask forgiveness for invoking that phrase, because I'm obviously not referring to my physical condition. I'm not out on the street. I'm not furtively living in an alleyway or huddling on top of a grate. I'm not smashed by the constant sound of the subway or battling demons in my mind. I don't lack for food or warmth. I speak here only of my spiritual condition. The difficulty of finding a home, a place to pray, a community to truly share with, and communicate about the challenges and possibilities of faith and religious practice in a very complex, dizzyingly beautiful, rich, and very troubled world. The German-Israeli philosopher Ernst Simon, changed his name to Akiva when he moved to Israel, once famously wrote, the people I can pray with, I can't talk to. And the people I can talk to, I can't pray with. I think that's a statement that Rabbi Soloveitchik might not assent to. Being able to find other Jews who are passionate about religious practice, but with fundamental ethical underpinnings, intellectually curious and accepting of a very broad range of ideas, no matter from where they derive, principled and yet truly loving and embracing genuinely of wide ranges of differences, be they differences of gender or sexual orientation or religious background or halachic sensibility. This seems rare to me, anyway, in our current environment. But we must learn to talk, if not to decide, simply to talk about the most fundamental issues that face us as Jews. And we must find a way to talk about them together with all members of the Jewish community, regardless of denomination. And we must discover how to disagree respectfully while learning from the other. And we must demand excellence from those who lead us and give them the commitment and the compassion that makes their task fruitful. Because we in the cosmos, as far as I know, are the only beings that know that we are alone. And the self-consciousness that accompanies that fact can either inspire us or defeat us. For Rabbi Soloveitchik, the ability to reach beyond this insularity is the key not only to a satisfying religious life, it's the key to a meaningful human life. He notes, "We dare not remain behind artificial walls, because if we cut ourselves off from the world, we shall lose it. Today's sanctifier is to be found in conquering life, not in removing oneself from it." So may we all have the courage to engage one another in truly life-enhancing ways and begin to find at least that key to the end of exile. In the words of Eric Fromm, infantile love follows the principle, "I love because I am loved." Mature love follows the principle, "I am loved because I love." Immature love says, "I love you because I need you." And mature love says, "I need you because I love you." I'll take questions. Or not. I'll repeat the question, that's fine. So, yeah, perhaps I wasn't so clear. To him, though, the reaching out for God, the reaching out for other people are reciprocal, they're interactive. So, first of all, you're talking about somebody who in many ways is highly conflicted, right? His work is highly conflicted because he's honest enough to be working through different elements, many of which are not necessarily compatible. Right? On the one hand, much of his work is steeped in this notion of what I tried to present here, which is this sense of deep aloneness and existential solitude, and the sense of really just a thin ice of absurdity beneath that. But on the other hand, he's a highly traditional Jew who's steeped in the halakhic system, who sees halakha, I mean, if you read Halakhic Man, as the anchor, almost transcending history, as this thing that you can go to that will ground everything. And I don't think that at all sort of comes together in the end. I think you're left with these contradictions. So on the one hand, really in many ways in the existential tradition, he both is torn by the idea of the deepest things in life being not communicable, but he feels an imperative to say that we need, A, to be responsible for ourselves, right, almost Sartre-like, like you have to be accountable for yourself. Can't look here, there, and elsewhere to get saved. But on the other hand, this idea, which is somewhat radical at that point, that you need to reach out, and I think it's because he's thinking about it theologically. Right? See, if you look in Wittgenstein, when it comes time when there's something that can't be communicated, so Wittgenstein says, okay, be quiet. Right? At the end of the Tractatus, he says, like, what you can't speak about needs to remain in silence. But for Rabbi Soloveitchik, because I think of this theological grounding, that God reached out at some point in history, right? That's the fundamental Jewish belief, right? So if you believe that, and it's a big if, right? If you believe that, and you believe that there's this reaching out in human history where God attempted to connect with human beings, and however you think about revelation, so to him, that is the paradigm, right? So now, because no one, right, in all Jewish thought, Hasidic thought, Kabbalistic thought, no one is lonelier than God, right? So if God reaches out of his own loneliness, so the idea here is that human beings can follow that pattern, can find, not necessarily get to the impenetrable in each other, but the very attempt and what accompanies it, which is more authentic conversation, more real, embracing, non-judgmental love. In fact, many of the things that I never see in Orthodoxy will have an impact, do have an effect, are important things to do. So it's, for him, not a contradiction to say, like, you know, you may never, never know the dark, dark place at the bottom of the well and the other human being, but if you don't do anything about it, if there's no coming together of any kind, it's much worse than if you make the attempt, that there is forms, approaches, steps on the road to redemption. So there's a parallel between the sort of impenetrability of the human being and obviously on a much more, you know, incomparable scale, that sort of silence of God. And he refers often to this Latin phrase, the Deus abscondita, the hidden God, right? He acknowledges that it's very hard. I was struck in the last presentation when the rabbi talked about the sense of fakeness in saying the Amidah with all of the tefillot about Eretz Yisrael. Point well taken. What struck me internally is that the entire thing is fake, of course, because as soon as you get up and say Baruch Atah Hashem, you know, and if you don't really believe it, in other words, if you don't actually have a sense of a present, personal, relating God, then almost every word you're going to say of that prayer is utterly inner contradictory. It's fake, to use, you know, his words. So I think that it's not a question of getting there, and it's not a question, because I think you're right, they're paradoxical, they're intention, and I don't think he resolves it. I don't think he intends to resolve it. I think in many ways he's saying, like, this is life. Life is not the easy fit. It's not all the elements will work themselves out, but there are better and worse ways of being authentic, right? In other words, he did not take the step to nihilism through the sense of the mystery. He didn't say, well, the heck with it, you know, we'll just do what we want. And I think that's because of the theology. Mm. So, now you're going to ask me questions about books that I gave you 20 years ago, and I've got to respond to them. First of all, I mean, look, from my point of view, I'm going to take your question one further. So the assumption of the question is that there's an authentic, monolithic Jewish tradition, that all of these things, I mean, this is obviously the Maimonides question, you know, that he corrupted Judaism, he stuck Aristotle in where it didn't belong. So the question is, what is Judaism, right? Do we practice biblical Judaism? Do we have the values of biblical Judaism? You know, do we, if you ask most people, like, what's Judaism? So they're going to say Tanakh at some point. They're going to say the Bible, surely, right? Are there not many values in the Bible that make you run for the exits? Right, so what does it mean? In other words, it's a very complicated business. Now, we can be honest about it, we can be dishonest about it. But if you're going to be honest about it, which we should try to do. So it's a tradition that's evolving, that grows, that accretes values, that modifies them, that tweaks them, that takes into account who it's speaking to and when it's speaking to people. So the trick, you know, which is a weekly conversation in my house, is how do you maintain this kind of basic mythos of Judaism, right? This basic structured theological tenets. We do this and we do this and we do this based on this and this and this, and yet allow for some kind of breathing where Maimonides is not like a sort of foreign object, but is actually integrating something possible. Now, I don't say that the guide necessarily is reflective of the Judaism that came before. And maybe Rabbi Soloveitchik isn't either. But if you're going to say that, so what do we say about Kabbalah? What do we say about the system of the Ari? I don't see Sfirot running around Tanakh or the Gemara, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it's like what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Or to use another tortured phrase, in for a penny, in for a pound. Like, if you want to say that's not Judaism, that's the Pandora's box right there, right? Right, right. You don't need to open it for me. It is open. The question is, what do we want to do about it? I mean, it is open already, you know. So I think that he's I can't remember who had said it. I think it may be Rabbi Kushner, would have been better to live at another time. He said, like, I don't know, this is the only century I got. You know, like, you live where you live, right? So Rabbi Soloveitchik is making the transition from, you know, the old world to the new world. He comes, he's smart, he's beyond smart, he's perceptive, he's intense, he's reading, he's thinking, he's troubled, he's tortured. Not just troubled, he's tortured, right, by these problems. And he's reacting, and he's integrating what he sees around him, and he's saying, this is what speaks to me about Judaism. Because even if you take it back, you say, like, all that stuff's rubbish, what would you actually put in its place? You know, it's like, what would you say is the Judaism that we're going to do, right? Does it ever come up a week without somebody giving a Devar Torah with their version of what Judaism really says and really thinks and really is? The dishonesty of it is that it's monolithic. In other words, it's monochromatic. Like, what I say, this is actually it. And there is no other, right? If you could count up all the times you heard somebody say, this is actually it, and all the contradictions involved, so you'd have 500 versions of this is actually it. So this is Rabbi Soloveitchik's it. Yes, sir.
And
Right. Let me just pop in here for a second. Right. So you're right. They're both sides of the debate. So you have, on the one hand, the religious thinkers like Rabbi Soloveitchik and others positing religion, God, belief, faith as the solution to the problem. On the other hand, you have Hitchens and his ilk who see religion as the root of all evil. There's obviously a contradiction there. And, you know, how do we reconcile both sides of the problem? Look, I mean, I think that this is a long discussion, but briefly, on one toe, forget about one foot. Look, I like Hitchens. I think he's a very smart, entertaining guy, but I thought it was a very bad book. And one of the reasons it's a very bad book is that anybody could choose the worst examples of religion and make it paradigmatic of how religion falls down. You could do that with a lot of books. So I think that the question of why people don't believe in religion is complicated. Obviously, some of it is because religion does not put its best foot forward. That was Hitchens' argument. But honestly, I mean, just I was just in England, reading an article about Amos Schocken, who's the editor of Haaretz. And, you know, his politics are not my politics. But in any case, during the war in Gaza, people were writing articles for Haaretz about, you know, how the Israelis are oppressing the Gazans and so on. So it was very, very left-wing. And even the readers from Tel Aviv went crazy. And they started writing letters to Haaretz saying, how can you do this? And this is treasonous. So Amos Schocken wrote back and says, so maybe Haaretz isn't for you. Right, he wouldn't actually defend himself. And the reason I'm saying that is like, because religion isn't for everyone. In other words, it's not like going to the store and buying food. The issue of having faith and believing in something you can't see and carrying out a system is not something I think you can judge other people for. You know, I don't consider a flaw in person's character if they, you know, don't see that there's a God that exists. So to some extent, it's what religion does, and to some extent, it's inherent in the problem of attaching yourself to religion. Any other questions? Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Well, in answer to the first part, I know very little about Rabbi Soloveitchik's personal life, and that's fine. I mean, he was married. His wife died 30 years before him, and he has a son and two daughters. One of the daughters married Rav Lichtenstein, and the other daughter married the late Isidore Twersky and his son Chaim Soloveitchik. To the second part of what you're saying, see, I think what he's doing here is, it's iffy. Because part of what he does is to wage, he does this very strange thing with modernity. Again, another contradiction. On some level, I mean, this gets to your question, he's pulling in all of these philosophical trends that are utterly modern, right, that are you won't see before, right? But on the other hand, he has a very stock, almost stereotypical view of secularism. You know, that it's degenerate, that it will lead to a lack of ethics, that you're, as you said, that the only ground really comes theologically. So he's really invested in this idea that this is really the only salvation is to God. He does not believe in any sort of redemptive possibility outside of that religious step, because to him, the existential facts are so true, the absurdity is so obvious, so evident, that you can't escape it, right? That everything else is just a ruse, it's an allude. Like, who are you kidding? Who are you kidding that, like, watching football and going out for dinner and all that's going to do the job? Or whatever, anything. Sex, drugs, rock and roll, you name it. It's not going to do the job for Rabbi Soloveitchik. So he has a very negative view of what that life brings. And he's put all of his eggs kind of in that theologically redemptive basket. Now, obviously, there's going to be a lot of people in this world who are not going to agree with that position. And, I mean, if you take a softer version of Hitchens, the argument reverses itself. And all the inauthenticity is actually on the side of the religious people. You know, you sort of fake crutch people who just, like, create these, like, you know, structures of illusion and use it to dominate other people. I mean, you know, the whole, you reverse the whole argument. So, you know, everybody's sitting on one side of the line looking at the other person's flaws. Part of what I tried to suggest at the end is that it's time to stop doing that. Like, if you're a thoughtful person, you can recognize that there's myriad, diverse, multiple value all over the place. And the truth is that while we in Jewish communities, like, quibble and squabble and nastier verbs with each other about, you know, minuscule things, we don't help each other. We don't actually address those real life gut existential problems of faith and doubt and how to combine a ground, a traditional Jewish ground, with a changing world and so on. Very, very tough questions, right? Unless you stick your head in the sand, it's tough to be both traditionally Jewish and to really be alive to the possibilities of the world. So the point is that whether you think like Rabbi Soloveitchik or you don't, we need to discuss these things. We need to discuss them in open forum. We need to have answers that aren't bad, paltry ones, but good attempts at really trying to work through the difficulties. And we need to do it in a place where it would be safe to do it, right? I've been running panel discussions for Torah in Motion for many years, as many of you know. One of the things that strikes me is that, first of all, probably less than half of what people think they say. Right? I mean, I hate to make you feel like you've wasted your money, but the point is that people do not feel safe. They do not feel safe to say what they really think about religious issues without having a kind of automatic stream of condemnation and judgment and so on. And so we are crippling our own ability to be authentic by sort of imposing these standards on discourse. So I think that it would be a good thing if we could, like, loosen the reins a bit that way. Yes, ma'am. Perhaps. He doesn't actually speak to me, to be honest with you. His resolutions are not my resolutions. Whether they're resolutions at all remains an open question to me. I suspect that they're not. But I appreciate the fact that he is struggling with those things. On some level, everything we do today has already been done before, and everything we do today has never been done before. I mean, because we keep recycling the same themes, but everybody is living in a different situation, and everybody has a different sort of relationship to the problems. So, you know, whether his predecessors would see him as doing what they did, in some ways, I guess. In other ways, I'm not certain. I don't get the sense, that there is a resolution there. I think that there is strong conviction about many parts of halachic life. But look, I'm an outsider. You know, I never met the man. I never learned with him. You have a whole cadre of people alive today who are directly under his influence, and I think that has pros and cons. I mean, I think that's a wonderful mentor to have, a wonderful influence to have, but whether you can take a step back and see other elements is a question. So.
All right, thank you. I got everybody here. That's your quote, yeah. To continue, sort of, tomorrow night we have a program after you eat and sleep and take a shower and all relaxed and you want to learn and get inspired from the day of Tishah. We're running a 2-week program, a Beit Midrash with Dr. Bryna Levy. And for those of you who don't know her, she's really one of the foremost women Torah scholars alive today. She's the first woman to get a PhD in Bible at Yeshiva University. She taught for many years at Michlalad, Midrash of Moriah, at Matan, which is where she is now. She runs the program in Tanakh. She's really a wonderful teacher. And tomorrow night is actually on Moshe Rabbeinu, between family and flocks. It's a 2-part series, Leadership and Family Challenges and Concessions. And next Monday night on Rabbi Akiva and his children, 7:30 to 9:15 at Or Chaim. Tomorrow night and next Monday. So I just invite everybody to attend. While we're here, I'll make one last pitch. If anybody wants to win a free trip to Florida and you buy a Tim Pass today, only today, now, in the next few minutes, for $249, which a lot of you buy anyway, that gets you free entry for the next year to all our programs. For today also, we're going to add in the people, we're going to raffle off 25,000 Aeroplan points. In addition to on Tim Pass, which you get a charitable receipt for, we have many, many wonderful programs, please God, that are coming up. And I want to wish everybody, I hope you had a meaningful fast. It's been a very long day for me. I've been at it since 8:30 in the morning, even though I only spoke in the morning. I want to thank, Dr. Lakshin, who helped me out this morning, who's here. And but I find, Tisha B'Av a very inspiring day. And there's a lot. It's an intense day. And I think that's the way we have to observe it. I think there's a lot, if I can use the expression, food for thought, and a lot to think about. And wish everybody all the best. Okay. Have a good last hour of the fast or so.